Welcome to another episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Ashley Hollowell, reporter with Behavioral Health Business, and I'll be your host this episode. Today I'm joined by Eric Cardenas, the CEO of Zocalo Health, a Latinx-founded and focused provider of behavioral health and primary care for patients in California, Texas, Washington, and soon Maryland and other territories. It has been well documented that the recent deaths and rates by immigration and customs enforcement across the country have taken a toll on many communities. Zocalo's clinicians and community health workers have witnessed a dramatic rise in anxiety, depression, and care avoidance tied to fear of raids and detention. The company's data shows that 3 in 4 patients now screen positive for moderate to severe depression. Over half meet the threshold for clinically significant anxiety. And since the Supreme Court ruling expanded ICE authority, suicidal ideation among its patients has sharply risen as well. The impacts have likely intensified since the increased actions in January. Zocalo Health is operating as a provider to a niche population experiencing extraordinary circumstances, all while under the umbrella of the Trump administration's pivot away from DEI initiatives. Today, Eric will share his perspectives on how he has scaled Zocalo during a tumultuous time while balancing risks, workforce recruitment and retention, and working with specific patient populations in crisis and beyond. Let's dive in. Welcome, Eric. Glad to have you here today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I'd love to dive in. I know we've talked previously about Zocalo Health and your rapid expansion into multiple different states. I'd love to hear how the company has expanded in what has really been a tumultuous healthcare environment for many providers. Tell me a bit about your unique care model, what's enabled growth during such a volatile moment for the communities you serve.
Absolutely. And thanks for the question. So to understand what we do, you have to understand a little bit of the history and why we started the company. So again, my name is Eric Cardenas, co-founder and CEO at Zocalo Health. And the reason why we started this company was really, it was born of personal experiences. I grew up in inner city Houston, Mexican immigrant parents who had struggled tremendously navigating our one-size-fits-all healthcare system. And for us, it was very common to make trade-offs between paying for a prescription or paying for the light bill. That is really what inspired me to take on a career in healthcare. And I won't bore you with all of those details, but it did inspire the creation of Zocalo Health. And so what Zocalo Health is we describe it as a tech-enabled, community-oriented primary care organization that historically has served Latino communities and other underserved populations. Now, as we've grown, what we typically do is we partner with Medicaid and managed care organizations to deliver integrated primary care experience. What this means is that we like to focus on addressing the fact that healthcare for a lot of people is fragmented, and we wanted to create an experience that integrated primary care, behavioral health, and also was really intentional about addressing the unmet social needs, right? So the trade-off that I described is one that I think a lot of people face. And so our model combines, you know, virtual bilingual clinical care with doctors and therapists that both speak English and Spanish. We have in-person community health workers or promotoras de salud. These are our trust builders that meet patients in their communities, in their homes, really bring care to the people. And we integrate all of this through workflows that really span, again, the medical, the behavioral, and the social care. So our focus has been on populations with high medical, behavioral, and social complexity, where fear, where instability, and fragmentation directly shape their outcomes. So our job basically is to keep people engaged in care, even when external conditions make that extremely difficult for them.
Thank you for sharing that context. And as you are well aware, there's a lot happening for the Latino and Latinx community right now, broadly. I'm wondering, has the current environment changed where or how you have prioritized expansion geographically, clinically, or otherwise?
Yeah, it certainly has. And again, just a little history here is, you know, when we started our company back in 2021. We spent a few years trying to figure out where this model would work best. We launched initially in Texas, California, and Washington State. And after a couple of years of gathering data, we started to pitch to health plans. And this is where managed care organizations in California really started to engage. And so we saw that the model was really effective in rural communities, which is where we started. We started in California Central Valley back in 2024, and we took this land and expand approach. What we saw is that health plans really liked the model because it allowed us to really serve communities that were dealing with provider shortages. So these are individuals who, although maybe they had qualified for Medicaid, they had a PCP, wait times were significant, especially for behavioral health. There are some counties where accessing a therapist could take anywhere from 6 to 12 months. And so this led to just very low value patterns of care among these populations. And what's important is that while we expanded and now serve, two-thirds of the state, we're expanding into Maryland, DC, Virginia, New York this year. We are seeing a lot of market pull. But when it comes to some of the immigration enforcement that we're seeing, it certainly impacts a lot of the communities that we serve. You know, some of the first communities that we were taking care of were in rural communities where there were a lot of rural migrant farm workers. And when some of the early stories were coming out about, immigration raids and things like that, we certainly saw this happen in many of the communities that we serve. And so it really turned into a real-time sort of public health stressor that really showed up directly in how we were providing services to patients and how we were screening folks for behavioral health, such as anxiety and depression and things like that. And this impacted utilization. It impacted patient behavior. It was something that we weren't really quite prepared for, but now in retrospect, we're not surprised. And it's something that we are really proud to say that, we're here for them. We're here for these communities that otherwise would have to had, foregone care or just try to figure out how to cope with these issues alone.
I understand you have specific data for your patient population as well. I know, I believe you had shared that after the Supreme Court ruling in September that expanded ICE authority, suicidal ideation in your patient population jumped from 1 in 30 to 1 in 8. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. We were seeing a lot of this ripple effect with our patients. And, we were very fortunate to have a team of therapists and our head of behavioral health, her name is Sofia Pajes. She is from the community. She serves the community, was one that started to really bubble these things up really, really quickly. We've seen spikes in anxiety, spikes in depression. We've seen trauma symptoms, suicidal ideation that was directly tied to enforcement events, to the policy changes. And we'd start to see, heat maps where, we were able to correlate these spikes with the activity in these local communities. And so absolutely. Right now, I think just some of the latest data that we have is that nearly 1 in 3 patients screen positive for clinical anxiety. That's the highest rate that we've seen since we started providing care. And It's been pretty drastic to see the suicidal ideation really increase from 1 in 30 to about 1 in 8 within months since we started to see some of these policies go into effect.
That's a huge jump and really significant statistics that you shared there. I'm curious too if you've heard from your patients or clinicians within Zocalo, is this time also changing the way that patients seek out care or the types of mental health care they are actively seeking? I know, for instance, I'm kind of thinking of, we've seen the reports of the different ICE raids causing families and individuals to, stay home out of fear. Is it also changing the way that they look for care?
Yeah. It seems like it's a paradox that we're dealing here, right? So clinical need is rising, but the utilization is becoming less stable. And so while we work really hard to create more capacity, the reality, the sad reality is that patients do delay care. They're delaying intake, they're canceling visits, they disengage. In some instances, they disappear entirely. And so, you know, it's unfortunate. It's something that's truly impacting these communities. And I'd like to say that, you know, they disengage or cancel visits because they're feeling better. But the reality is that what we're seeing right now is that this fear is reshaping their behavior. And so what we've started to really zero in on with some of our patients, for those that do engage, you know, after multiple attempts. So the beauty of our model is that while our therapist may be available virtually to our patients, when they disengage, we typically will have our community health workers go out into the community and try to find patients, try to regain trust. And what we're seeing is that it's not just the cancellations or the no-shows. It's we're recognizing that people are just prioritizing safety over care. They're prioritizing keeping their families intact. We're seeing their daily routines are being disrupted. We're seeing just a reduction in movement and socialization. It's starting to feel like in some instances we're seeing families sort of isolate, you know, some in a similar way, similar to what we saw during COVID, right? But instead of a disease, instead of a virus, it's the community, right? It's they're dealing with policies that are really, really detrimental to their health.
Absolutely. And with that, are you and your team working on any strategies to re-engage some of those patients who were previously really engaged and maybe have walked back due to some of these concerns? How are you kind of meeting them where they're at this moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult situation, right? You know, we obviously don't want to just resort to a clinical response, right? It has to be operational. It has to be cultural and relational, right? We want to make sure that we leverage our model in its entirety. As I mentioned, community health workers are extremely essential in helping to regain trust, right? Going to people where they feel the most safe. And sometimes, you know, people don't come to us and say, hey, you know, I'm anxious, I'm going to stop showing up. Sometimes we see it because we notice that their medication refills are not being filled. We might see that they're not completing, you know, certain forms to renew SNAP benefits or other social benefits. And so that's the beauty of our model, that we have this integrated team that can kind of pick up on the cues and we can start to see where people are disengaging. So that's important. But what we want to do is make sure that we really work through our strategies and really understand what's happening in each of the communities. We partner with community-based organizations. We partner with meal delivery providers. We partner with folks that help just address the acuity of this pain point that these individual families are going through, and really, really work hard to just regain trust. At the end of the day, we only can move at the speed of trust. And so we do what we can to regain that trust. We work with our CHWs, provide them with very specific training. Our behavioral health team is working through group meetings. We're working through WhatsApp to get more messaging out, to really normalize and name the things that we're seeing in the community. And slowly but surely, we start to see some re-engagement. And that's where we see the magic of the model kind of come to life. I think what we really, really think about that has been effective, just to give you some specifics, is that we also help, you know, families ahead of any sort of action that's being taken in their communities around, like, just what does family preparedness planning look like? What does, you know, helping our patients understand like their rights, right? So like rights education. We've also helped with resources around safety and contingency planning. Those are all things that, again, help us bring some preparation, right, to the families. It helps them feel like they have a little bit of control in a situation such as what we're facing in some of these communities. And so that, you know, I think is key to really helping sort of set the tone that we're here for them and that we're not going to bail on them at any point.
Right. A little bit of control in a situation that feels uncontrollable goes a long way. Feeling like you have support to gain a little bit of that control and autonomy back as an individual, I'd imagine, in this environment. One of the things I'm curious to ask you, this is something I've heard from several other sources throughout 2025 and early into 2026 as well, but with the Trump administration's walk back away from DEI language, I know that that has been something targeted in grants and contracts at a federal level. I'm curious how Zocalo has adapted its funding and messaging strategy in that way to support the Latinx, Latino communities without compromising its mission. But also, that's obviously a core part of your care, having it culturally rooted for these populations. So how have you navigated that?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I like to say to folks that ask about this particular question is that, you know, DEI was not a feature of ours. We didn't select it because it was trendy. We built this company to focus on underserved communities because we come from underserved communities. And so for us, it wasn't necessarily that we needed to change our model or something that was, again, just a feature or a fad. It was something that was part of our DNA. And what I want to make sure is that people understand that when we serve these communities, it wasn't, you know, a niche. You know, we were serving a Latino community, which in many of the communities that we serve, you know, when you look at the data, especially in California's Central Valley, 2 out of 3 Medicaid recipients were Latino. And so we weren't building a brand necessarily for a niche. It was for the majority of the people that were going to benefit from these services. And so when a lot of the policies that we now know about, right, were really targeting some of the DEI language, you know, what it forced us to do was not to change who we focus on, right? Again, the people who need us are the people who need us. I think where we really stand apart and where we really sort of set ourselves apart is that we have always been about not just improving outcomes and experience for patients, regardless of where they come from. We also know that if we were successful in doing that, we would reduce costs for health plans. And so in the era, right, when we started the year off last year with like the talks about DOGE, right, and cost reduction, that, yes, had a negative impact on what we call the safety net, right? We're still seeing ripple effects of that. But where we've really been able to take this perceived headwind and turn it into a tailwind is that we were purpose built for addressing the pain points that health plans have today, which is that right now, if you think about it, 5% of a Medicaid health plan's population typically represents about 50% of the cost. So our focus is to work with the most complex, really help control costs for the health plan, and allow them to do more with less. And that alone right there is the value proposition that we bring to health plans and to patients, which has led us to really grow our business over the last 18 months. And so nothing has changed. We're still here to serve the underserved. You know, we recognize that, you know, our members are largely underrepresented, you know, Black and Brown communities. We're building care that's culturally competent. We'll build it to make sure that, you know, we drive engagement and adherence, that we're actually solving pain points for them, right? But at the end of the day, the thing that maybe we have to emphasize just a little bit more, first and foremost, is that we're here to be good stewards for the limited resources that are flowing through Medicaid and Medicare. And at the end of the day, we're about cost reduction and allowing health plans to do more with less.
This next question may be a little bit in that same vein, but I'm curious if there's anything you might add on. So I'm going to ask anyway. When you are talking to health plans, payers, investors, or you know, other funders, How do you specifically make the case for culturally rooted care, especially when the outcomes you're addressing are often tied to a lot of these, at least currently, political stressors and social stressors?
Yeah. The proof is in the pudding, right? You have to basically show that maybe some investors don't know all the details of what culturally competent care means. You know, to some folks, it may mean, oh, you're talking in Spanish. They don't see the deeply rooted training that we provide to our community health workers, to our physicians, to our therapists, the fact that we hire from local communities, the fact that we address not just, you know, the clinical drivers, but, you know, the social drivers, the fact that we really are able to meet people where they are, you know, dealing with the constraints that, you know, my parents had to deal with. That all really blends into what we think culturally competent care means. And so we may not always get into those details. I think at the end of the day, you know, funders of any business want to know that you are able to build a big business that is driving the results that you say you're able to achieve. And for us, over the last 18 months, we've been able to show that not only could we do well with like our first health plan customer in 2024, but that we've now expanded to serve over 14, maybe now going up towards 18 health plans in multiple states. And the data that we have, while it takes time to prove that you can reduce costs, what we're doing right now is able to show that we're driving engagement, that we're driving retention, that people are adopting a higher value pattern of care that addresses their social, their clinical, their behavioral health needs. And that right there is a really good signal that this is the type of business that you can invest in, and that it's not only doing good in terms of business, but it's doing good in these communities that have largely been underserved. And again, have largely been dependent on a safety net, on philanthropy. And we're saying, no, like we could build a sound business model. We can hire people, pay them competitive wages, and deliver an experience that is equivalent to the types of experiences that maybe you and I would expect out of our healthcare system. And so, it's sometimes less is more when talking to investors about the nuances of culturally competent care. And right now, I think the things that speak the most, that speak volumes, is just the results. And we're very fortunate that over the last, 18 months or so, we've done a really great job in creating value for the entire value chain. That includes patients, health plans, you know, our providers, our community health workers, the communities that we serve. Everyone sees the value in what we do.
A moment ago, you were mentioning culturally rooted care and all that Zocalo does that payers, investors, others may not be aware of, all that goes into the training behind that. So I'd love to hear you dive into a little bit more about exactly how you do train Zocalo's clinicians to be culturally rooted in the care, and what kind of aspects do you bring in to ensure that that is continuous throughout every patient interaction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best way to describe our cultural competency is in really just understanding that when you talk to folks, especially when we started really with a focus on the Latino community, we knew that, again, trust was everything. And, you know, I'll give you some anecdotes. It's important to recognize that one size fits all is really not going to work when dealing with the Latino community specifically. Growing up, I always knew the concept of respeto, respect, right? That's just one anecdote in many where, you know, you have to really get familiar with people before really getting into the business, right? How you greet people, how you shake their hand, how you talk to them. There's a difference between tú and usted, right? It's just the formalities. And it's those little details that really make a difference when establishing trust. You also have to keep in mind that people that we deal with today, that we connect with, they're dealing with a lot. And we also knew that we couldn't just put them in front of a doctor on day one, right? If it wasn't necessary, if possible, we wanted to put them in front of a community health worker, because a lot of folks are dealing with housing insecurity, food insecurity, and it's not just about them, it's about their family. There are several sort of isms that we deal with within the Latino community, familism being one of them, right? That you oftentimes are putting the family before yourself. And so some of the training that we provide is how to navigate that, how to first address these social barriers, right? By asking people, how can I help you today? How can I help you survive the day? How can I help you get through the things that are keeping you up at night? And it's going through these appropriate assessments, you know, asking them in the right sort of framework without sounding too aggressive, without sounding disrespectful. Those things matter. And it's those details that matter that allow us to ultimately help address those pain points first and foremost before getting into the clinical side, right? So I know that if I go in and sort of reprimand a member for saying, hey, you haven't taken your medications in 3 months, that's not going to land anywhere. And it's very likely that they will not return. But if I instead focus on, hey, I understand that the food stamps run out, that last week is really tough for you. What if I can get some, you know, meals delivered to your house? What if I can help you enroll in this benefit program? And also recognizing that sometimes people are like, well, I don't want a handout. And that's another cultural thing, you know. So it's being able to pick up on these cues, develop a plan, work through these barriers that are either social or at an individual level. And it's all part of how we navigate that with an individual. And so making sure that we provide a consistent experience from the community health worker to the physician, to the therapist, to, you know, our housing navigators, that is where the real magic happens and how we truly connect with patients, not in a one size fits all type of situation, but in a, you know, one size fits one. And that's really, really important when dealing with a population that, again, is dealing with a lot, especially with all the stuff going on right now.
Certainly. And I'd imagine, too, that even as you were mentioning, you know, something like the difference between two and instead, a handshake, or just addressing how someone can get through the day, whether they might be needing SNAP benefits or meals delivered, et cetera, just finding the root of what these individuals need, particularly at this time, I'd imagine would make these connections with Socalo's patients stickier than maybe they would be if they had gone to a provider that didn't have these culturally rooted foundations. Do you find that your patients are more deeply engaged and you retain them as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is where, you know, going back to one of the metrics, right, that we share with our, you know, investors, our prospective investors, is that 85% of our members come back to us every month. And so when you take that metric and you really think about it, you know, we're talking about Medicaid, where it tends to be sort of a high churn sort of cohort. And with Medicaid, to see that level of retention, typically people will churn out, not because they're dissatisfied or not getting their needs fulfilled. It's typically they lose eligibility, right? Maybe they get a job, maybe they move. Those are the primary drivers for why people churn out. And so to have that retention really is a testament. And not only that, you know, we get a lot of really great feedback from our members, you know. And the thing is that by building, again, a business here that is really focused on continuous improvement, we get to take that feedback and invest in, you know, an experience that really resonates with the community members that we serve. And not only that, but we also focus on our clinicians, our providers, you know, whether it's our physicians, our therapists, we recognize that their job is extremely stressful. And a lot of the people that we bring in to work with us, you know, they've worked for safety net providers. They've been burned out. They've gone through that grind. And our goal is to not put them through the same experience, but to really get them back to doing the work that they enjoy. And that's where we are really doubling down on those investments, because if they are happy, if they're able to provide the level of care that they want, there will be a better connection with patients. And it just, again, it has a ripple effect on entire households, entire communities. And that's exactly the vision for Zocalo Health.
One thing I'd imagine that you may have likely heard from investors before is targeting a specific population could confine market growth, but Zocalo has expanded really rapidly, and you mentioned several of the new areas you're looking to expand into throughout 2026. How do you respond to that argument of confining market growth by focusing on a niche population like the Latinx community?
Yeah. I mean, it's a question that we do get a lot. And, you know, we are very fortunate to say that, you know, our model has been hyper-focused on again, underserved communities. And yes, we started with the Latino community. But the beauty is that this model scales, right? You know, as I mentioned, our community health workers live in the communities that we serve. And so if a health plan starts to pull us into zip codes where it's a different demographic, guess what? We hire from that community and the model scales, the model adapts. And so we never, you know, built this with the intention of keeping it constrained or focused on niche markets. Our focus is on delivering results. And so I think investors understand that, you know, and we're seeing the market pull today where we have health plans asking us to do more. And that's a positive signal. It's a signal that just demonstrates that the model was well thought out, that the training will expand. We're in the process right now of really implementing some regional org structures that allow us again to keep the feel of our model local. But to that extent, it scales and it adapts, and it will allow us to take this early data of what we call our wedge, right, which is to provide this intensive care coordination for Latino underserved communities, and prove that it could be replicated, it could be repeated in other communities in a similar fashion.
I'd love to hear how, to the extent you can share, how you are keeping the localization feel of that model local and central to the work that you do. You mentioned you're implementing some regional org structures. What does that look like in practice?
Yeah. You know, one of the early tests for us was how do we take an engagement model that was highly effective in rural parts of California, and how do we drive similar results in maybe some more of the urban or suburban markets across California? So we expanded into the Bay Area. We've expanded into LA County, the Inland Empire. And that's really challenged us to really think about how we show up in communities. And so in communities like Merced County, for example, we knew that there were not a lot of resources for communities. There were a lot of community-based organizations that offered various services, but due to limited budgeting constraints, you know, how they showed up in the community was sometimes limited. People didn't know that they existed, that they had resources to offer folks. And so we took a very community-rooted approach. One of the things that we're really proud of is our Cafecito, Cumbia, and Salud events, which revolve around basically renting out a coffee shop, a local coffee shop. It's locally owned. We'll take it over for a day and we provide coffee. We invite community-based organizations to come share resources, so they're carefully curated by our team. We usually pick some content, whether it's behavioral health topics, whether it's chronic condition topics. And we partner with our health plan partners to basically curate a community event, a celebration, if you will, that really allows us to celebrate the community. It really brings education. It really brings awareness. And in communities like Merced, California, where, you know, there's not a lot typically going on, and a lot of events that are really geared towards like the family on a random Thursday afternoon, we get a really great turnout. And this leads to engagement. It leads to conversation. It leads to community building. It has been a really effective way in helping us earn people's trust, you know, build brand awareness, awareness of the services that we provide. And doing this is a little bit more difficult in, for example, LA, right, where there are many coffee shops. And so for us, having to adapt that model and really think about how to do that in the urban core, you know, it forces you to think differently. It's not a simple rinse and repeat. And so what we're doing differently in LA is we're doing full-blown community assessments in some of the communities that we're being asked to provide services. And we take great pride in recognizing, you know, patterns and where people are. And instead of asking people to come to us at our one-off event, right, that may occur, you know, once or twice a month, we're instead doing things like setting up community resource centers inside of grocery stores, inside of laundromats, so that we could basically meet people where they are. And that has allowed us to really think about engaging people in a unique and very community-rooted way that may not always work in other communities. And so we take great pride in trying new things and bringing healthcare to you know, locations and communities in ways that maybe others haven't. We also take great inspiration from models at work that, you know, we've seen work in other states. And it's great just to see how people engage when you're able to, you know, talk to them about stuff and really maximize their time. For example, when they spend a couple hours doing laundry, or when they're getting a haircut, right? Or when, you know, you get to connect with them and their family right before they do some grocery shopping. And so those are ways in which we really, really think about bringing a regional approach to engagement.
I'm curious, what does Zocalo's experience signal, do you think, for the broader behavioral health industry about mental health demand and its relationship with public policy right now?
That's a great question. I think that, first of all, there's obviously a trend that we can't ignore. It feels like AI is taking over every headline. We certainly get asked about it and how we plan to deploy AI in our current business. And, you know, I think a lot of people tend to lean towards, like, is this going to replace therapists? Is this going to replace physicians? Is it going to replace, you know, the care delivery model altogether? And while, you know, I think there's a lot of things to be excited about when it comes to AI, and, you know, the fact that it can automate a lot of the back office, it could automate a lot of the rote tasks that we deal with in healthcare. I think especially when it comes to behavioral health, you know, I really do hope that we do not over-index on trying to deploy AI to replace the relationships, to replace the connection that we think is really, really important when serving vulnerable communities. I think that right now, especially when systems have sort of eroded trust, right, with HHS giving up data on undocumented members to the current administration, that type of trust is hard to regain. And introducing technology in the wrong way with the wrong intentions, I think, is something to really keep an eye on. And I think we're going to see a lot of policies and guidance on how to use it. I think that it's just going to be really important that we, as a community, recognize the importance of connection and trust building, and don't try to accelerate things faster than they should. Because again, as I mentioned earlier, this community, the community that we serve, moves at the speed of trust. And that's something that we will never take for granted.
Absolutely. And as you're well aware, I'm sure, you know, marginalized populations like the ones that you serve are often also affected by, you know, medical racism and these other systemic issues that have all historically deterred trust from some of these institutions. So, as you mentioned, going about it in a way that can revitalize that trust will be very important. So, if you could give one piece of advice to healthcare leaders or investors looking at growth opportunities in behavioral health right now, especially when a lot of communities are under acute stress due to some of these lingering public policy issues, what piece of advice would you give them?
You know, I think as an entrepreneur, I have to share that you have to be a little crazy to take on some of the hardest problems. And I think that we all have to especially right now, lean into that. You know, lean into the challenges ahead. Recognize that, you know, there is a lot that's going to happen. We still haven't seen the end of it. There are going to be long lasting ripple effects due to some of the policy changes, due to fiscal policy, due to just how, like, healthcare is just, it's, I always tell people that healthcare, you know, has always long been sort of represented safety and refuge. And right now we have to work back. And I think that it's going to be people, entrepreneurs, people who are eternal optimists that are going to be the ones to get us through this. And right now we have entire communities that need us. We need folks to really help us meet this moment. And we should not perceive this as, again, a headwind, but rather as a call to action, right? We need innovation. We are also at an inflection point where technology can be a force multiplier. We have all the right ingredients. We just can't let ourselves be discouraged by the negative, and instead find possibility in all of that to basically meet the moment and really, really stand up for communities that need us right now.
So where will Zocalo's focus be throughout the rest of 2026?
Yeah, we're really excited in that we have health plan partners that are asking us to expand into new states. So the DMV area is an area that we're going to be investing in. New York is an exciting state that we are currently exploring. So we're really excited about, you know, going over to the East Coast. We've also have been partnering with other risk-bearing entities, so non-health plan entities, which has created a lot of really great strategic opportunities for us to explore. And so we're really excited about 2026. We capped off a great 2025 with some significant growth, and 2026 looks to be just as promising. And so the challenge just comes down to execution. Can we deliver? Can we build off of the vision? And you know, I was just sharing with my team that it takes ambition to get here, but it takes discipline to stay here. And that's the thing, is that we're really focused on bringing this model to as many people as we can, because we know it works. And so, yeah, we'll expand to a few more states, and then we'll see what happens after that.
It'd be great to see what's next for Zocalo. Eric, thank you so much for being with me today and sharing your perspectives. I really appreciate your time.
It's always a pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Ashley Hollowell with WTWH Media. Until next time.